Steve, in his classic way, basically said, go make it great. He didn't want to come to pre-production meetings or script consultations or casting or the shoot. He just said, go make it great. Mike Murray. And then they hired Ridley Scott. Ridley Scott. When I first saw the boards, I thought, my God, they are mad. It was such a dramatic idea that it would either be totally successful or we'd all get put in the state pen. Lee Clow. Ridley Scott had just finished doing Blade Runner, and so we were using a famous director, and we were going to do something really special. Ridley Scott. From a filmic point of view, it was terrific, and I knew exactly how to do a kind of pastiche on what 1984 maybe was like in dramatic terms rather than factual terms. Mike Murray. It was the first time that a filmmaker, a movie maker, had been hired to make a commercial, because in those days, that was considered dipping way down and becoming very commercially crass. Ridley Scott. So I've always looked at each commercial as a film, as a little filmlet. Lee Clow. Ridley is an amazing professional. We had some great discussions about everything from wardrobe to where the spot should be. At one point we were talking, maybe they should be marching through the mud from Quonset huts. And that gave way to what you ultimately saw in the film. Ridley Scott. Those two big black walls at the back of the main auditorium, we hauled in two huge 747 engines and just hung them on the wall. And they looked like, what did they look like? I don't know, they looked like ducks. So that is to me what I call good dramatic bullshit. Mike Murray. I remember Jay Chiat from Chiat Day went over to London, and during the filming he sequestered himself behind a whole bunch of cardboard boxes because he was frightened, because those guys in the ad who looked like they're skinheads, they were. Ridley Scott. We organized one of these rather frightening casting sessions where there were about 300 or 400 youths, and we chose 150 skinheads out of that group. Mike Murray. And whenever they'd have breaks in the filming, these guys would all go out and get these bags with glue, and they'd be sniffing glue. They were truly scary, scary people. So Jay told me afterward that he hid during the filming of this very famous commercial because he was afraid they were going to come and get him. Lee Clow. It ended up being what it's become, a legendary commercial. The commercial's been talked about so many times over the years with different people describing as to what the genius of it was. I always suggested that it was a lot of things all happening just right with some serendipity thrown in. An amazing product, a client that wants an amazing commercial, a great director, and then the Apple board. Mike Murray. So we get it done, and we are told we need to show it to the board of directors, and Steve is chairman of the board. It was Phil Schlein and Mike Markula and Art Rock and Henry Singleton and Steve and maybe one or two others. I remember very clearly going into that board meeting. We had a TV on one of these rolling carts, and we send it out and we show it. They roll tape. Big Brother is on a television of enormous size, addressing a crowd of zombified skinheads. Suddenly a beautiful young blonde wearing a Macintosh-branded tank top and red hot pants runs to the front of the crowd while swinging a hammer. She throws it at the looming image of Big Brother. It's a bullseye, and the giant television explodes. As the action fades out, the words fade in. On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh, and you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984. Mike Murray. Phil Schlein has his head down on the desk. On this big boardroom desk, head down, and he's pounding on the desk. Boom, boom, boom. And I think, he got it. He's with us. That's one vote. And then Markula turns to Jobs and says, you really want us to run that? John Scully. Then they all turned and looked at me because I was the adult supervision. You are not going to really run that thing. Lee Clow. John Scully, who originally approved it, then decided that he hated it because the board hated it. Mike Murray. And it was such a horrible feeling, though, because all of us knew it was the epitome of the greatest ad of all time, and it was such a huge disconnect between us and our board, who were then on, from our own point of view, just a big bunch of schmucks. Bill Atkinson. Apple management didn't want it to air. They ordered Steve to sell the time back. Lee Clow. So he sold off all the time except for one 60-second window during the Super Bowl, which, not by accident, we didn't sell. Mike Murray. So Steve talks to the board, and the board says, well, then we will run an Apple II spot. So they went to the vault and looked at them, but none of them were relevant. So reluctantly they said, all right, run it. And it was shown on the Super Bowl. Steve Wozniak. And there's Big Brother on the television saying everybody has to think the same. Big Brother, lecturing the skinheads. Today we celebrate the first glorious anniversary of the Information Purification Directive. We have created, for the first time in all history, a garden of pure ideology, where each worker may bloom secure from the pests of contradictory and confusing truths. Our unification of thought is a more powerful weapon than any fleet or army on earth. We are one people, with one will, one resolve, one cause. Our enemies shall talk themselves to death, and we will bury them with their own confusion. We shall prevail. Andy Hertzfeldt. It was clearly an allegory. Most commercials aren't allegorical. Steve Wozniak. You know, kind of like IBM world, everybody has to have the identical thought. Contrary thoughts will not be tolerated. And then the young track lady with the red outfit throws a hammer at Big Brother on the big screen, and it explodes, and everybody's just gasping. A new world is coming. Oh, my God, that was the most incredible thing I'd ever seen. An incredible piece of science fiction. Ridley Scott. We nailed it. Bill Atkinson. It won a Clio. Mike Murray. The following night on ABC, CBS, and NBC, those were the three networks then, it was shown as news. Not as advertising, not as PR. It's Dan Rather and Peter Jennings saying, Apple Computer has introduced a new computer called the Macintosh. And they showed this outrageous ad, and they would show it in its entirety. The Macintosh itself debuts a couple of days later at the Flint Center on De Anza Junior College campus in Cupertino. Jobs is the MC. But before the big reveal, he delivers a short Valley-centric history lesson. John Markoff. There had been leaks ahead of the Macintosh for years, literally, and so there had been tremendous buildup. There was the failure of the Lisa. Already the connection between the work at Xerox PARC and Apple technology was well known, so there was this expectation that this was the future of computing. All of that was palpable. Steve Jobs, from the stage. It's 1958. IBM passes up the chance to buy a young fledgling company that has just invented a new technology called xerography. 2 years later, Xerox was born, and IBM has been kicking themselves ever since. It is 10 years later, the late 60s. Digital Equipment Corporation and others invent the mini computer. IBM dismisses the mini computer as too small to do serious computing, and therefore unimportant to their business. DEC grows to become a multi-hundred-million-dollar corporation before IBM finally enters the mini-computer market. It is now 10 years later, the late 70s. In 1977, Apple, a young fledgling company on the West Coast, introduces the Apple II, the first personal computer as we know it today. IBM dismisses the personal computer as too small to do serious computing, and therefore unimportant to their business. Randy Wigginton. Steve loved to point out how other people screwed up and how he's amazing and stuff. Steve Jobs from the stage. The early 1980s, 1981, Apple II has become the world's most popular computer. and Apple has grown to a $300 million corporation, becoming the fastest-growing company in American business history. With over 50 companies vying for a share, IBM enters the personal computer market in November of 1981 with the IBM PC. It is now 1984. IBM wants it all and is aiming its guns on its last obstacle to industry control, Apple. Will Big Blue dominate the entire computer industry? The entire information age? Was George Orwell right? Randy Wigginton. The Mac Group had the first three rows of the auditorium to sit in, and we were eating it up. Bruce Horn. We really did think that this was going to liberate people from the tyranny of big computing. Randy Wigginton. Like, here we are. We are freedom fighters. The Empire is about to win. The Death Star has moved into position, and we are the only ones there that can save the planet. Steve Wozniak. The Macintosh was going to lead to big problems later on, but he convinced us all. I believed it was the future. John Sculley believed it. Steve convinced us all, and we believed it. Randy Wigginton. We actually believed it. Yukari Kane. Looking back, there's definitely an irony there. Apple is now an empire, the most valuable company in the world. And once you become an empire, you are the establishment. Steve Jobs from the stage. There have only been two milestone products in our industry, the Apple II in 1977 and the IBM PC in 1981. Today, 1 year after Lisa, we are introducing the third industry milestone product, Macintosh. Many of us have been working on Macintosh for over 2 years now, and it has turned out insanely great. For his finale, Jobs pulls the Macintosh out of a bag, plugs it in, turns it on, and walks away so that Macintosh can introduce itself while sitting unattended on the podium at center stage. John Markoff. Macintosh spoke when it came out of that bag. The Macintosh computer from the stage. Hello, I'm Macintosh. It sure is great to get out of that bag. Unaccustomed as I am to public speaking, I'd like to share with you a maxim I thought of the first time I met an IBM mainframe. Never trust a computer you can't lift. Steve Jobs. When it was introduced, after we went through it all and had the computer speak to people itself and things like that, the whole auditorium of 2,500 people gave it a standing ovation. And the whole first few rows of Mac folks were all just crying. Randy Wigginton. It was Steve at his finest. It was amazingly choreographed. It was a show to beat all shows. Andy Cunningham. It was a hugely successful launch. I think it got more publicity than any launch that has occurred before or since. So it obviously worked. John Markoff. Macintosh was Steve's marketing sensibilities coming into full flower. It was orchestrated in a way that he would later routinize. The on-stage presentation format, the dramatic unveil, the secret, and all of that. Everybody is still playing the same script that Steve invented, basically. Mike Murray. So then the next board meeting 3 weeks later, they summon the Mac senior team, and when we all go into the boardroom, they stand up and clap. Bill Atkinson. And so, one of the biggest differences when the Mac finally shipped is it was the first computer that people really fell in love with. People actually would say, gosh, I want one of those. How can I justify it to my spouse? Jaron Lanier. I remember bringing one to MIT. Look, there's a Xerox PARC machine that you're actually going to be able to buy in the store. And they were like, wow! Fumbling the future. Who blew it? Xerox PARC or Steve Jobs? Tasked with building the office of the future, the scientists and engineers at Xerox PARC churned out a slew of ideas, most of which ended up in another company's computers. 1984's Macintosh was PARC's Alto. watered down and reimagined as a consumer product for the computing masses. That fact pretty much everyone can agree on. But in Silicon Valley, the ultimate significance of this technology transfer is still a matter of debate. Was Apple's visit to Park the Promethean moment, where Steve Jobs stole the graphical user interface from Mount Olympus in order to give it to us mere mortals? Or is that oft-told story just Valley hokum and myth-making, and furthermore, fundamentally backward? To hear the story as told by some who were actually there, Jobs wasn't astute enough to recognize what Park had actually invented, and thus he stole the wrong thing. The Macintosh copied the Altos look and feel, but none of its deep structure. In this telling, it was Steve Jobs himself who fumbled the future, because if Jobs had truly understood Park's fundamental breakthrough, and had kidnapped that too, then we really truly could have had the power of a Prometheus. Alvy Ray Smith. Okay, so what did Xerox do? Chuck Thacker. Xerox was doing pretty well in the copier business. They had this big, fat cash cow that they could just milk, and these upstarts come in. Alvy Ray Smith. They just could not believe that people who looked like us could have business ideas. Dick Shoup. I looked like a complete homeless hippie person. Chuck Thacker. They had no idea what they had. Bob Taylor. Most of the stuff that people use today when they use a computer, Windows, a bitmap display, Ethernet, electronic mail, servers of all kinds, distributed computing architecture. Alvy Ray Smith. And color graphics and the Windows-based UI and all of that. And then the laser printer. I mean, it was just all happening. The personal computer was being invented. Bob Taylor. All that stuff was invented by Park. Alvy Ray Smith. Here they had the gift. The computer was theirs, and they could have been the computer company of the world. Steve Jobs. They could have owned the computer industry. It could have been the IBM of the 90s. It could have been the Microsoft of the 90s. Trip Hawkins. It's one of the greatest examples of disruption in history. How badly they blew it. How far ahead they were. What they could have had. How easily they could have had it 10 years before anybody else. And how they kept blowing it over and over, even when they had plenty of time to catch up. It was pretty bad. Alvy Ray Smith. They had everything, and they kissed it off, and everybody cried. All the supposedly hardcore scientists like Alan Kay and Dick Shoup, these guys literally cried when they heard that Xerox Corporate was kissing off the computer. Alan Kay. Business people should be shot. They always say, we are in business to make money. And I say, well, not really. You just want to make a few million or billion. But the return from Park is about 35 trillion. Count those extra zeros and tell me what they are really doing. They are just trying to be comfortable. Alvy Ray Smith. And when I was a young Turk, that's what I thought too. They really blew it. Alan Kay. The whole thing was just a complete bust. But the urban legend about Xerox not making money is completely false. Xerox made billions on the laser printer. They paid for Park several hundred times over. They just missed everything else. Alvy Ray Smith. They kissed off everything except the laser printer. The only thing they kept out of all that was what they absolutely knew really well, and that was the laser printer. Chuck Thacker. Because Xerox wasn't a computer company. Alvy Ray Smith. What you say in business these days is they stuck to their core competency. Their core competency was black and white, ink on paper, right? That's what they did. Alan Kay. They just were so brain dead and so unable to understand anything about any process that was not simple business. Alvy Ray Smith. Did they make a mistake? From a corporate point of view, probably not. After having started two companies myself and having had all the young Turks come to me and say, Alvy, we should do this, 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 and this. it becomes quickly evident that you can't do every bright idea that comes down the pike. You just can't. You have to prune the tree, and your job as management is to prune the tree and stick to what you know. I still think they blew it, though. Bob Taylor, it's pretty clear that Xerox fumbled the future. Butler Lampson, but the fumbled the future idea is quite misleading. Obviously, it's true that Xerox developed all this technology, and the only real benefit of that was the computer printer. But in fact, they made a huge effort to commercialize it in the form of the Star System. They set up an independent division, a so-called System Development Division. They had a very good engineering team, and this engineering team had a vision of what it was they wanted to build. Chuck Thacker. The Star was the beginning of the era of what I call scientific workstations, because they were built for performance and much less so for cost. Butler Lampson. And they built it, much to my astonishment. They shipped the Star System in 1981, and it was better than anything you could buy from anybody else for at least a decade. The irony of this is that back at Park, there were people like Chuck and me who were saying to these guys, this is too ambitious. It's going to cost too much. You should build something much more like the Alto. But they didn't do that. Charles Simonyi. At the time, I was working at Star basically out of necessity, and I was very frustrated. I saw biggerism. Chuck Thacker. Biggerism. I think I coined that word. It grew out of an observation that had been made by Fred Brooks in his book The Mythical Man Month. One of the things Fred pointed out is that the second system is the hardest one. When you're building your first system, you're very careful because you've never done it before and you use well-understood engineering principles. And if you get it right and you are successful, then you feel great and you're willing to tackle something that's much bigger. And that's where the danger comes. This goes under the mantle of the second system syndrome. That's what Fred called it. But it's also exemplified in something called Myhrvold's first law of software, which is that software expands to fill the available space. It's like a gas. Charles Simonyi. Star was biggered to an unbelievable extent. Chuck Thacker. It was a biggered version of the Alto. Bob Taylor. The Star was designed to be not just a computer, but a complete system. And it was very expensive because it had many components. Printers, Ethernet, computers. Adele Goldberg. Minimum buy was 4 Star workstations on a network with a printer and separate storage. You shared storage. Bob Taylor. And it sort of out-designed itself in a way. Its abilities could not live up to the ambitions. So it fell short. It was too slow. It cost too much. Charles Simonyi. The Star was not going to work. We were not going to win. Chuck Thacker. So Simonyi went to Microsoft. Charles Simonyi. In February of 81, I drove my car up to Seattle and started working right away. Alvy Ray Smith. Years later, I was at Microsoft and I met up with Simonyi. He took me over to his mansion there on Billionaire's Row on Lake Washington. I said, how did you happen to leave? He says, you guys thought that you were at the center of the universe, didn't you? I went, yeah. He said, if you had met this kid Bill Gates and talked to him and heard his vision like I did, I realized you guys are not the center of the universe. This kid is. He left and went with Bill. Adele Goldberg. Back at Park, we wrote a detailed proposal for a machine we called the Twinkle. The Little Star, and we told them that they could have product out in a year if they were willing to go with a 68,000-based implementation of Smalltalk, running a simple text editor and painting program with the mouse interface and some tutorials for how to do all that, and hooked it up to printing. We pretty much had the prototypes done. It needed to be productized, and it could have been out in 83. We worked hard on that. And we sent that to Office Systems Group, and we never heard anything back. Not a thing. Bob Taylor. Xerox could have re-engineered the Alto to make a better machine than the Macintosh, I believe, but they chose not to do that. They did not make another run at the fence. Adele Goldberg. And then in 84, out comes the twinkle, but they called it a Macintosh. We all had the same idea. So we looked at it and we thought, too bad. We could have done that. We would have had that out. Bob Taylor. Remember, Apple failed with the Lisa. Lisa was their first attempt. Butler Lampson. Lisa had exactly the same properties as the star system, and it failed for exactly the same reason. Bob Taylor. And so Xerox looked at that and said, we're done. Butler Lampson. But Apple had a second go-around with the Mac. With a lot of pruning, as well as the advantage of 3 years later technology, they were able to make something that was in many ways quite similar to the Alto. Bob Taylor. Computers previous to the Mac, I would regard as toys. But I don't regard the Mac as a toy. It was just a very weak manifestation of an Alto. Very weak. I mean, it fell far short of the Alto in every respect except cost. Alan Kay. When I got to Apple, I wrote a memo. The title was, Have I Got a Deal for You? A Honda with a 1-quart gas tank. The first line of it was, Looks great in your driveway, but don't try to go down to the corner store for a pack of cigarettes. And went on from there. It was short. It was like 2 or 3 pages. It was pointing out, Hey, what the fuck are you guys doing? Andy Hertzfeld. Everyone knew what he meant. The main thing he was referring to was RAM. And we knew it didn't have enough RAM. It was just completely a technological compromise. Dan Kotke. RAM was just very expensive in those days, and we're talking about an all-graphic screen. It's all RAM you're looking at there, so it's very expensive. Bruce Horn. The Mac was simply not big enough to do any sort of object-oriented programming system. Basically, if you look at a Mac, and you look at Smalltalk, you have a mouse, you have overlapping windows. In the Mac, you had pull-down menus, and you had modelless text editing. Other than that, there's no Smalltalk. It's not programmed in Smalltalk. It didn't use Smalltalk concepts under the hood. So there was basically no Smalltalk, or any Smalltalk concepts whatsoever inside of the Mac. Alan Kay. So you wound up with something that was skin-deep compared to what the park thing was, but that had lost the soul of everything being accessible, everything being malleable and so forth, and we never got it back. And that messed things up forever. That messed things up to today. Bruce Horn. Computing could have been this incredible tool for everybody. That was the vision of people like Doug Engelbart, Alan Kay, people like that. They were all basically trying to make the world a better place through computing. And personal computing is the most powerful way to extend an individual's human abilities. That's the bottom line. So, for example, one of the things that Doug always said is, boosting mankind's capability for coping with complex, urgent problems. That was the point of his work. His life's work. Andy Hertzfeld. We couldn't be in the world we are living in today with Doug Engelbart's approach. Doug Engelbart did not care about making his software accessible. He really couldn't care less. Doug didn't care about it being easy to learn or really that easy to use. He cared about what you could do with it, increasing human potential. It couldn't work for ordinary people because ordinary people have very low tolerance for complexity. Steve saw that as much as anyone. He had such a passion for simplicity. And he's right. If you want it to be mainstream, it's got to be as simple as possible. You never could have gotten to 1 billion people using it if you had a learning curve that took weeks. So you know both ideas are right. It's a balance. Dan Ingalls. I look at it as a great collaboration. It may not have been planned that way, but that's how it happened. Alvy Ray Smith. Everybody says Steve Jobs ripped off Xerox PARC. He didn't. Bill Gates did. He took Simonyi, who didn't just know the look of the Alto, he knew how it worked. And Simonyi came up there and wrote Word and Excel based on stuff he had done at Xerox PARC. That was the end. That was the real taking of the guts of the place. Jim Clark. Sun Microsystems were really the ones who copied Xerox PARC. They made a workstation that would do what the Xerox Alto would do. A bitmapped graphical workstation. Chuck Thacker. There aren't a whole lot of good ideas in the world, really. I mean the fact that the graphical user interface that we got together at PARC has lasted for as long as it has is to me quite amazing. Why haven't we been able to do better? Bruce Horn. I think that there is another computer revolution to be had, and we haven't had it yet. And a bunch of us are very sad about that and trying to figure out ways to make it happen. But there's just so much momentum and so much money and so much investment. If you think about Windows and all the people who have to do Windows support and so on, there's this huge financial infrastructure to keep it the way it is. And you know society doesn't like to tolerate risk, and anything that allows you to have access to the internals of the computers is risky. So it's very difficult to give people a canvas, a computing canvas on which to paint. Alan Kay. Computing is terrible. People think falsely that there's been something like Darwinian processes generating the present. So therefore, what we have now must be better than anything that had been done before. And they don't realize that Darwinian processes, as any biologist will tell you, have nothing to do with optimization. They have to do with fitness. If you have a stupid environment, you are going to get a stupid fit. Bruce Horn. I thought that computers would be hugely flexible, and we could be able to do everything, and it would be the most mind-blowing experience ever. And instead, we froze all of our thinking. We froze all the software and made it kind of industrial and mass-marketed. Computing went in the wrong direction. Computing went to the direction of commercialism and cookie-cutter. Jaron Lanier. My whole field has created shit. And it's like we've thrust all of humanity into this endless life of tedium, and it's not how it was supposed to be. The way we've designed the tools requires that people comply totally with an infinite number of arbitrary actions. We really have turned humanity into lab rats that are trained to run mazes. I really think, on just the most fundamental level, we are approaching digital technology in the wrong way. Andy Van Damme. Ask yourself, what have we got today? We've got Microsoft Word, and we've got PowerPoint, and we've got Illustrator, and we've got Photoshop. There's more functionality, and, for my taste, an easier-to-understand user interface than what we had before. But they don't work together. They don't play nice together, and most of the time what you've got is an import-export capability based on bitmaps. The lowest common denominator, dead bits, in effect. What I'm still looking for is a reintegration of these various components so that we can go back to the future and have that broad vision at our fingertips. I don't see how we're going to get there, frankly. Live bits where everything interoperates. We've lost that. Bruce Horn. We're waiting for the right thing to happen to have the same type of mind-blowing experience that we were able to show the Apple people at PARC. There's some work being done, but it's very tough. And yeah, I feel somewhat responsible. On the other hand, if somebody like Alan Kay couldn't make it happen, how can I make it happen? Book 2. The Hacker Ethic. We are as gods, and might as well get good at it. Stuart Brand. What Information Wants. Heroes of the Computer Revolution. By the mid-80s, the technologists who were creating the future in Silicon Valley started to see themselves as more than simply engineers. Alvy Ray Smith and his midnight crew at Xerox PARC, the game makers at Atari, and the Macintosh team at Apple all became convinced that they were pioneers in a new expressive medium. They felt like designers, authors, even artists, and they wanted to be recognized and compensated as such. But while the engineers fought their individual battles for money and credit, it took a writer from New York City to realize that this new class of creatives added up to a bona fide culture, complete with its own lore, jokes, and ethic. Stephen Levy made the argument in a popular ethnography entitled Hackers, Heroes of the Computer Revolution, and the weekend-long book party for its release was the first Hackers Conference. At the confab, the backers of Silicon Valley, and beyond, met each other for the first time and awoke to the fact that they had nearly everything in common. Stephen Levy. When I first started writing about technology, I did a story for Rolling Stone about hackers at Stanford, but it turned out to be totally different than what I thought it was going to be. I thought I was writing about kids in college that were computer addicts, but I picked up on all the excitement involved in the personal computer revolution. So after that Rolling Stone story, I wanted to write more about it and got a book contract for Hackers. Originally, it was with one publisher, but my editor went to Doubleday and I went with him. Doubleday was also doing the Whole Earth Software catalog. Kevin Kelly. Nobody was reviewing software then. It was considered completely nerdy, insignificant, hard to review. Software was floppy disks being sold in little baggies, produced in people's bedrooms. What was good? What wasn't good? Nobody had any idea. So Stewart's idea was, well, this is going to be big. Let's start reviewing this and make a guide to it. We'll have a Whole Earth Software catalog. Stephen Levy. The publisher spent $1.3 million for it. It was the most that was ever spent at the time for a softbound book. Fred Davis. The Whole Earth Software catalog would be the digital follow-on to the Whole Earth catalog, and this would be a mega blockbuster. That was what we all hoped. Kevin Kelly. When they started to hire for the Whole Earth Software catalog, Stewart wrote me an email and asked me if I'd come out and work for them. I like to say that I was the first person hired online. This was early 84. A lot of people were hired. Fred Davis. I was young and wet behind the ears, just excited to have a chance to work for one of my heroes reviewing products. Fabrice Florin. I edited the video section. I was a budding television producer at the time. Stephen Levy. I became the games editor of the Whole Earth Software catalog and, you know, played volleyball at Gate 5 Road and got to know Stewart, who's like one of the most amazing people on the planet. That was great, so I was connected with those people. And when I finished my book, I showed it to Kevin and Stewart, and they really liked it. Kevin Kelly. I read Hackers, and I was blown away because I knew nothing of this world. It was all new. I mean, new for me, because, of course, Stewart had written about the Hackers in 72. He had been tracking this a whole decade earlier. Stewart Brand. When I submitted that article to Rolling Stone in 72, Jan Wenner said, this is going to set in motion a whole lot of reporting about these computer hackers and all of this. And I thought he was right about that. But it turned out there was a 10-year hiatus between when I did that article and when Hackers came out. So the lifetimes that I experienced around computers made it seem always very slow and kind of boring and frustrating. Kevin Kelly. For me, there was this new interest in this culture that was emerging around the programmers. I was talking to Stewart about the fact that there were three generations of hackers, and they hadn't met. They themselves didn't know about each other. Stewart Brand. And Kevin said, what if we can get those three generations together? Kevin Kelly. And the one genius of Stewart's is that he will often take an idea, and unlike me, he'll actually try and do something about it. He said, we're going to do this. And he just kicked into his make stuff happen mode. Stephen Levy. They had a series of meetings with an advisory committee on who to invite. I was on the East Coast, so I didn't go to a lot of them, but I went to some. Andy Hertzfeld was on the committee, I remember. Andy Hertzfeld. So I got a phone call from Stewart Brand, and once a week for 7 weeks, we drove up to Sausalito. There were like seven hackers he got to design the Hackers Conference. Stewart Brand. We got a pretty good influx of folks. There was Ted Nelson, obviously, Lee Felsenstein, the sort of master of ceremonies for the homebrew meetings, which I had never gone to, but his reputation was good. Lee Felsenstein. By that time, homebrew had ossified. It wasn't new people coming anymore. There was the same old faces. I called it the Old Farts Society. We had the meetings for the Hackers Conference at the tugboat that Stuart Brand lived on in Sausalito. The meetings were mostly where we threw out names of who else ought to be invited. Andy Hertzfeld. My main contribution was just corralling the Apple crowd. I made sure all the key Mac people were there. Lee Felsenstein. The launch of the Mac had been in January, and the conference was in November of 1984. Stephen Levy. It was on the weekend that was literally the publication date of my book, so it was like a giant book party. At that point, you could sometimes get a copy of the New York Times book review a little early. I just spotted one for the first time in the airport bookstore while I was flying out there, and so I picked it up, and there was a tiny little capsule review of Hackers. It wasn't a full review. They trashed the book and said that it wasn't a real book, just an overblown magazine article. I was super depressed on the flight. It was just awful. I just wrote my first book, and it's dead. I'm ruined, I thought. Kevin Kelly. We had the conference at Fort Cronkite in southern Marin. It was barracks, really primitive barracks. Stephen Levy. It was at this old army camp in the headlands. A beautiful place, Fort Cronkite. Kevin Kelly. And so some of the people who we invited came. The number 114 sticks in my mind. I think that was maybe the number of people that finally were there. They were all hackers to varying degrees. I think there was only one or two women, maybe three or four. All the rest were guys. David Levitt. The Hackers Conference tried not to be a boys' club, but they did not try that hard. Stephen Levy. When I got out there, my spirits soared. All those people were there, and what they shared was that personality which I wrote about in the book. So it was like a living proof that what I wrote about was really there, no matter what happened to the book. It was the most amazing book party. Captain Crunch. Wozniak was there, Stuart Brand was there, Ted Nelson was there. A lot of the basic people from Homebrew were there. A lot of the founding fathers were there, definitely. A lot of the old school hackers. John Markoff. I was there, hanging out. Fabrice Florin. You really had all the players all in one place. It was a big deal. Michael Nymark. I remember thinking to myself that this was a moment, a really significant event. Lee Felsenstein. It really was a gathering of the Illuminati. The important thing was that all the Illuminati had never before gotten in a room at the same time. Ted Nelson. It was the Woodstock of the computer elite. Stephen Levy. It was like a secret culture until then. So now you would say, boy, what would the ideal computer conference be? Who would be there? And you would say, oh, you'd have Mark Zuckerberg and Larry Page. Well, this was like that, but they were people you never heard of. But they were the people who really were driving things, the secret inventors of our culture. They were all there. None of them were really famous. Even Steve Wozniak, everyone knows him now, but he wasn't so famous then. He was just getting to be known a little bit, maybe through the U.S. Festival and some other things. But basically back then, no one knew or cared to know who these people were. We just introduced ourselves the first night. Fabrice Florin. It started in the evening, everybody coming in. It rained a lot. It was gray skies, which was good because we just needed to be inside. Lee Felsenstein. That's a hacker thing, too. Fabrice Florin. We all gathered in one large room, and we formed a circle. Everybody started talking about who they were and what they were doing. So there was a lot of palpable excitement in the room that these people were meeting for the first time. Stephen Levy. This was the moment where the consciousness of that time really became something that you could pick up on. Just like in the gay movement, where there was a time when people just felt incredibly alone, that there was no one else like them. There was this consciousness that came out there. Oh, this is who I am. Kevin Kelly. Back then you had hippies and you had preppies. The nerds were just so off the radar that encountering them was exhilarating because you realized, oh, these are my people. Stephen Levy, I think it's fantastic that now in high schools people can be themselves, whether they are gay or a hacker, right? Lee Felsenstein, it was really a very inspiring kind of occasion, that sort of general inspiration, hey, we are here, we can get together, we can do things together, we are interesting people. Stephen Levy, the other thing was the laughter. Every session was joyous. People were really funny. There was so much laughter throughout. I don't think I've ever been to a conference where people laughed more. Captain Crunch, Wozniak was pulling pranks on me. He'd go into my room and hide my stash behind some computer somewhere, and I'd have to go looking for it. Kevin Kelly, there was also that nerd humor. Now we all recognize it. Reddit, XKCD, The Big Bang Theory, that was it. Now this is sort of mainstream, but at that time it wasn't. Stephen Levy, it was a shared humor out of a shared experience there. And even though some people had never met each other, it was like you were part of a crew that had worked together for years and years. It was like inside jokes with people you'd never met before. They were also just genuinely funny. Fabrice Florin, so a lot of discussions that first night. Stephen Levy, it was sort of a surprise to me how amazingly it was set up. They knew because they had hackers on that committee that we were going to go all night and that we were going to need to have the machines on, though the power did go out. Captain Crunch, people were kind of speculating that Woz had something to do with the power being cut off. Stephen Levy, it went dark, but they kept going. They just kept talking. They were all in the same head. It was like this incredible energy. They had so much to talk about. They were just like talking to each other. They hardly noticed. Then the power came back, and there was all this excitement again. Fabrice Florin, I remember having basically a lot of interesting conversations, including the one with Bill Atkinson. Bill was one of the designers of the Macintosh. He had an idea at the time which he hadn't coded yet, but he was thinking about it. It was quite revolutionary. Kevin Kelly, Bill was noodling with the idea of hypertexting, but didn't have anything to demo at that point. He was talking about his ideas. Fabrice Florin, Bill described this vision for enabling people to browse through nodes of information and jump from one node of information to another so they could learn by association, through serendipity, and be able to click on hyperlinks and just jump from one piece of information to another. It was based on the same concepts of hypertext that Ted Nelson and Doug Engelbart had been talking about for decades before. We all sit on the shoulders of giants. We're all inspired by these ideas. Bill Atkinson, I viewed what was later called HyperCard as being a software erector set where you could plug together prefab pieces and make your own software. Christina Woolsey, it was basically a way to take your personal documents and link them together. Just remember when the Macintosh came out, it had an object on it that no one had ever seen. 1984 is when the mouse was something you could buy on a machine, and the mouse and linking go together. If you have a pointing device, linking is a natural piece. You can click on this, click on that. Fundamentally, the mouse and linking are the same. Bill Atkinson. Looking back, I sort of see that HyperCard was kind of like the first glimmer of a web browser, but chained to a hard drive. Fabrice Florin. Then immediately after the group discussion, people went downstairs. We had lots of tables and computers. It started looking more like a hackathon, which back then was a novel concept. It probably came out of this hackers conference. But essentially you had all of the tables and you had the Mac designers showing off their latest stuff. Andy was showing his latest hack. Andy Hertzfeld. Software. Groundbreaking software is at its most dramatic at the very beginning. Kevin Kelly. Andy was jumping up and down, he was so excited. He was literally jumping up and down, and he was calling his hacker friends over, and he wanted to show them something he had hacked up the night before. Andy Hertzfeld. Switcher was written the day before. Fabrice Florin. He had done a hack just for the hackers conference. Andy Hertzfeld. I said that, but that was a lie. I wrote Switcher because there was a 512K Mac, not because there was a hackers conference. Stephen Levy. At that point, the fat Macs were just coming out. Kevin Kelly. He was working on a fat Mac, and something he calls Switcher allowed you to have more than one program open at once, and you could switch between them. Fabrice Florin. Because before a switcher, you had to basically open an application and then quit it and open another one. Stephen Levy. Basically, switcher was a way to hack multitasking on the Macintosh, which you couldn't do at all. No computer did that. No personal computer allowed you to do multitasking, so it was incredibly valuable. Kevin Kelly. He'd just done it the night before, just pulled it out of his own brain.
But the cool thing was seeing him explain it and show it off to other hackers and see that this was actually the currency. This was the dynamic.
He was doing stuff and giving it out to everybody. Yeah, here's a copy of it. And they were going to go and hack on it some more. It was just the very thesis that Stephen was talking about in his book. This hacker ethic of sharing and building upon in an open source sense. And there it was. It was right there. Stephen Levy. It was just like endless demos and showing people things and cool stuff. They hooked up the games. David Levitt. Amazing games no one had ever seen before. Fabrice Florin. They were up until the wee hours just showing off stuff, discussing, hacking, teaching each other how to do stuff. Lee Felsenstein. A lot of people had stayed up pretty late, and it was a hostel with these sort of pro forma beds that they were using with waterproof mattresses like in prisons. Stephen Levy. We were in bunks. It was cold at night. Stuart Brand. What we knew was that hackers would be perfectly comfortable in low rent circumstances. And they were. Kevin Kelly. This was still early days, so they weren't like the billionaires that they later would become. They were people who had real jobs and had some money, and they were camping out basically for a weekend. Fabrice Florin. Then in the morning, Stuart Brand went through the dorms and started kind of kicking the beds and saying, anybody who wants breakfast, now's the time. So you had all these droopy figures heading out to the little cafeteria. That next day, the conference portion of the Hackers Conference started in earnest. There were no featured speakers. The whole point was to get the hackers talking to each other. Fabrice Florin. We had different topics. I forget exactly what the topics were, but there's one that's an evergreen topic that's still being debated today. Stephen Levy. The hacker ethic was a term I coined to describe what I noticed was a shared set of values that hackers of any generation all have. You know, the way they saw the world and the way they operated and what drove them. The way the hackers saw it was that information should be free. That's what I tried to grapple with in Hackers, what that meant. Stuart Brand. It was a discussion when the whole group was gathered. It was talk of free software versus commercial software. Stephen Levy. It was one of the first sessions in the conference, the session that launched a million other sessions. Every conference in the last 20 years has had at least 1 to 10 sessions on that very subject. And here I was discussing it for the first time, and probably with the best audience, the best participants. It was amazing to moderate, if you want to call it that, a session like that, because it was so participatory. People were chafed, and they all wanted to talk. Everyone wanted to get in on it there. Doug Carlson, at the Hackers Conference. The dissemination of information as a free object is a worthy goal. It's the way most of us learned in the first place. But the truth of the matter is, what people are doing has more and more commercial value. And if there's any way for people to make money off it, Somebody's going to try to get an angle on it. So I think that it ought to be up to the people who design the product whether or not they want to give it away or sell it. It's their product, and it should be a personal decision. Robert Woodhead, at the Hackers Conference. Tools I will give away to anybody. But the product? That's my soul that's in the product. I don't want anyone fooling with that. I don't want anyone hacking into that product and changing it, because then it won't be mine. Steve Wozniak at the Hackers Conference. Hackers frequently want to look at code like operating systems, listings, and the like to learn how it was done before them. Source should be made available reasonably to those sort of people. Not to copy, not to sell, but to learn from. Stuart Brand. Wozniak made the point that there's a whole bunch of work creating a piece of software that does something useful and actually works well. Steve Wozniak at the Hackers Conference. Information should be free, but your time should not. Stuart Brand. So putting these things out for free is kind of nuts. And I said, well, software, this kind of information, wants to be expensive, but it also wants to be free because it's so easy to copy. John Markoff. It was a dialectic, right? Stuart is not a Marxist, but it was a very Marxist view of the information economy. Stephen Levy. It was a conversation. They were engaging. The whole thing was almost like a jazz improvisation, just like building up in one of those long Coltrane songs or something like that. Stuart Brand. I was really just restating something that was written down in Levy's book as the hacker ethic. Stephen Levy. Information should be free. Stuart Brand. My only addition to that was to take away the should and turn it into a want. Stephen Levy. He hacked me. That's the way I put it. Stuart Brand. Information wants to be free was the meme that got loose and went viral from that discussion. Kevin Kelly. It was just another throwaway line at the time. There was no sense at all that this would become Stuart's most famous saying. He said so many brilliant things over the years, I'm still surprised that this is what wants to be on his tombstone. Stuart Brand. It's giving information its own desires, I think, that makes people jump. Stephen Levy. It sort of sang in its own way and described something that was happening, and would happen much more on the Internet in a way that just made people grasp it. Kevin Kelly. Maybe the reason why it was launched into prominence is because of what I call the zero price point option, the idea that free would become this huge economic model and would come to dominate much of the wealth that was being generated. There was maybe a glimpse of that there. Stephen Levy. Information wants to be free on the Internet in particular. Stuart Brand. The quote in full is, information wants to be expensive, and information wants to be free, and that's a paradox which will never go away. And the quote keeps reviving, because that paradox keeps driving people mad.
The Whole Earth Electronic Link. Welcome to the restaurant at the end of the universe. The Well started as an experiment in community and publishing, in the future, all things that Stuart Brand was expert in. From a technology standpoint, it was little more than a glorified BBS, bulletin board system, hacked together from a few telephone lines, a couple of early modems, and a nearly obsolete computer from the 70s. Still, a broad swath of notables from Silicon Valley and the greater San Francisco Bay Area joined Brand's primitive social network seeking, like him, to understand the new online world. What they discovered when they logged on was a bohemia and a frontier. That the Valley, circa 1985, was also a bohemian frontier was no coincidence. The Well was Silicon Valley Online. The Well attracted hackers from the Hackers Conference, as well as Brand's many high-flying friends from the disparate worlds of journalism, ecology, philanthropy, and business.
Almost immediately, the well became the place to be in cyberspace, and in fact is the place where the word cyberspace first acquired its contemporary